This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents Rite of Passage, written by Alexei Panshin, narrated by Elizabeth Evans.
Chapter 1. To be honest, I haven't been able to remember clearly everything that happened to me before and during trial, so where necessary, I've filled in with possibilities. Lies, if you want. There is no doubt that I never said things half as smoothly as I set them down here, and probably no one else did either. Some of the incidents are wholly made up. It doesn't matter, though. Everything here is near enough to what happened, and the important part of this story is not the events, so much as the changes that started taking place in me 7 years ago. The changes are the things to keep your eye on. Without them, I wouldn't be studying to be an ordinologist. I wouldn't be married to the same man, and I wouldn't even be alive. The changes are given exactly. No lies. I remember that it was a long time before I started to grow. That was important to me. When I was 12, I was a little black-haired, black-eyed girl, short, small, and without even the promise of a figure. My friends had started to change, while I continued to be the same as I had always been. And I had begun to lose hope. For one thing, according to Daddy, I was frozen the way I was. He hit upon that when I was 10, one day when he was in a teasing mood. "Mia," he said, "I like you the way you are right now. It would be a real shame if you were to grow up and change." I said, "But I want to grow up." "No," Daddy said thoughtfully, "I think I'll just freeze you the way you are right now." He waved a hand. "Consider yourself frozen." I was so obviously annoyed that Daddy continued to play the game. By the time that I was 12, I was doing my best to ignore it, but it was hard sometimes, just because I hadn't done any real growing since I was 10. I was just as short, just as small, and just as flat. When he started teasing, the only thing I could say was that it simply wasn't true. After a while, I stopped saying anything. Just before we left Alfingquad, I walked in with a black eye. Daddy looked at me, and the only thing he said was, "Well, did you win? Or did you lose?" "I won," I said.
"In that case," Daddy said, "I suppose I won't have to unfreeze you. Not as long as you can hold your own."
That was when I was 12. I didn't answer because I didn't have anything to say. And besides, I was mad at Daddy anyway. Not growing was part of my obvious problem. The other part was that I was standing on a tightrope. I didn't want to go forward. I didn't like what I saw there. But I couldn't go back either, because I tried that and it didn't work. And you can't spend your life on a tightrope. I didn't know what to do. There are three major holidays here in the ship, as well as several minor ones. On August 14th, we celebrate the launching of the ship. Last August, it was 164 years ago. Then, between December 30th and January 1st, we celebrate year end. 5 days of no school, no tutoring, no work. Dinners, decorations hung everywhere, friends visiting, presents, parties. Every fourth year, we tack on one more day. These are the two fun holidays. March 9th is something different. That's the day that Earth was destroyed, and it isn't the sort of thing you celebrate. It's just something you remember. From what I learned in school, population pressure is the ultimate cause of every war. In 2041, there were 8 billion people on Earth alone, and nobody even had free room to sneeze. There were not enough houses, not enough schools or teachers, inadequate roads and impossible traffic. Natural resources were going or gone, and everybody was a little bit hungry all the time, although nobody was actually starving. Nobody dared to raise his voice because if he did, he might disturb 100 other people. And they had laws and ordinances to bring the point home. It must have been like being in a library with a stuffy librarian 24 hours a day.
and the population continued to rise. There was a limit to how long all this could go on, and that end was reached 164 years ago. I'm lucky, I know, even to be alive at all. My great-great-grandparents were among those who saw it coming, and that's the only reason I'm here. It wasn't a case of moving elsewhere in the solar system. Not only was Earth the only good real estate in the vicinity, but when Earth was destroyed, so was every colony in the system. The first of the great ships was finished in 2025. One of the eight that were in service, as well as two more that were uncompleted, went up with everything else in 2041. Between those 2 years, we ships planted 112 colonies on planets in as many star systems. There were 112 at the beginning, but a fair number simply failed, and at least seven acted badly and had to be morally disciplined, so around 90 still exist. We and the ships learned our lesson, and though our ship has only a small, closed population, we won't degenerate. We won't become overpopulated either. We have a safety valve. Within 3 months of the day you turn 14, they take you from the ship and drop you on one of the colony planets to survive as best you can for 30 days. There are no exceptions, and a reasonably high percentage of deaths. If you are stupid, foolish, immature, or simply unlucky, you won't live through the month. If you do come home, you are an adult. My problem was that at 12, I wasn't afraid to die, but I was afraid to leave the ship. I couldn't even face leaving the quad we lived in. We call that month of survival trial, and I don't think there was a day from the time I was 11 that it wasn't in my thoughts at least once. When I was 11, a man named Chatterjee had a son due to go on trial, and he had serious doubts that the boy would make it. So he went to a great deal of trouble to try to ease the boy through. He found out where his son was to be dropped, and then he coached him on every danger that he knew the planet had to offer. Then, before the boy left, he slipped him a whole range of weapons that are not allowed to be carried on trial, and he advised him to find a protected spot as soon as he landed, and to hole up there for a month, not stirring at all, thinking the boy might have more of a chance that way. The boy still didn't make it. He wasn't very bright. I don't know how he died. He may not have been able to cope with one of the dangers he knew was there. He may have run into something unexpected. He may have accidentally blown his head off with one of those weapons he wasn't supposed to have. Or he may have simply tripped over his own feet and broken his neck. But he didn't live to come home. And Mr. Chatterjee was expelled from the ship. He may have died too. This may sound harsh. I can't judge. It doesn't really matter whether or not it's harsh, because it was necessary, and I knew that it was necessary long before I was even 11. At the time, however, this made a great impression on me, and if I had been able to force myself to face things outside the confines of the quad in which I lived, I would have rested much easier. There may have been other reasons, but I suspect that all this is why when Daddy became chairman of the ship's council, he decided that we had to move. Boys and girls, all of us in the ship grew up playing soccer. I'm sure I knew how to play by the time I was 4 or 5, and I was certainly kicking the ball around earlier than that. We used to play every chance we got, so it wasn't surprising that I was playing soccer in the quad yard, Alfing Quad, 4th level, when I got word to come home. The yard stretches 3 floors high and 200 yards in each direction. There's a regulation-sized soccer field, green and beautifully kept, in the yard, but some older kids newly come back from their month of trial and feeling twice as tall because of it had exercised their privileges and taken the field for themselves. We had moved down to the smaller field set up in the far end and were playing there. In soccer, you have a 5-man front line, 3 halfbacks who serve as the first line of defense and who bring the ball up so the forward line can take it and score, 2 fullbacks who play defense only, and a goalie who guards the nets. It's a game of constant motion that only stops when a penalty is called, or when a ball goes out of bounds, or when a score is made, and then stops only for a moment. I was playing the inside left position on the forward line, because I have a strong left-footed kick. It's my natural kicking foot. From midfield, trying to catch my breath after running hard, I watched our goalie dive on a hard boot at the nets. He was up almost instantly, bounced the ball once, then held it, and kicked it high and long. The goalies are the only players on the field who are allowed to touch the ball with their hands. The rest of us have to use our heads, elbows, knees, and feet. That's what makes the game interesting. Our right halfback knocked the ball down and trapped it with his foot. The instant he had control, he passed the ball over to Mary Carpentier at center halfback, and we all started ahead on a rush for the goal. The ball crisscrossed between our halfbacks, running behind us up the field, almost as though it had a life of its own. A round brown shape that darted and dodged and leaped in the air, but was always caught and controlled, never quite getting away. Once, the other team intercepted the ball and it went back past midfield. But Jay Widener picked off a bad pass and we began to rush again. Finally, Mary Carpentier headed a pass to me when I was in the clear for a moment. I had a step on Venny Morlock, who was playing fullback against me. She was big, but slow. Even having to concentrate on keeping the ball moving in front of me, I was faster than she was. I had a good opening for a shot at the goal, when Venny saw she couldn't get the ball. She swerved into me, gave me a neat hip, and sent me skidding onto my face. I was running full tilt and couldn't help myself. I went flying and hit hard. My kick went bouncing out of bounds wide of the white posts and the net of the goal. I looked up, sputtering mad. "Soccer is not a contact sport," I said. It was like Venny to pull something like that if she saw no other way to keep from losing, and especially to me. We were confirmed old enemies, though I think it was more of a deliberate policy on her part than on mine. Just as I scrambled up from the floor, the wall speakers whistled twice for attention. There were always announcements coming over the speakers. This time, they were calling for me. They said, "Mia Havero is wanted at home. Mia Havero is wanted at home." Ordinarily, Daddy didn't have me paged and let me come home when I was good and ready. There was a woman named Mrs. Farmer who used to tell Daddy that I was undisciplined. But that wasn't true. When Daddy did call for me, he only had to call once. "Time for you to go home," Venny said. "Run along." The immediate flash of anger I had felt when I was skidding along had passed, but I was still smoldering. "I'm not ready to go yet," I said. "I have a fresh kick coming."
"What for?" Venny demanded. "It's not my fault that you ran into me."
If it was my own fault that I'd wound up on the ground, I had no reason for complaint. If it was Venny's fault, then I had a shot at the goal coming on a major penalty. That's soccer. I guess Venny thought if she denied doing anything long enough and loudly enough, somebody would take her seriously. Mary Carpentier, my best friend, spoke up then.
"Oh, come off it, Venny," she said. "We all saw what happened. Let Mia take her shot so she can go home."
After some fruitless argument on Venny's part, everybody agreed I had a free kick coming. I set the ball on the X mark on the ground, in front of the goal. The goalie was Mrs. Farmer's son, Peter, who was younger than I and slow enough to be put in the goal. He poised himself with his hands on his knees and waited. The goal is 8 feet high and 24 feet wide, and the ball is set down 36 feet away. The goalie has a big area to cover, but in two quick steps, he can reach any ball aimed at the goal. It takes a good shot to get by him. Both teams stood behind and watched as I backed off a step or two from the ball. After a moment, I ran, faked a kick with my good left foot, and put a weak right-footed kick dribbling just past the goalie's outstretched fingers into the corner of the nets. Then I left. I dodged into the outside corridor and made straight for my shortcut. I unclipped a wall grate that provided an entrance to the air ducts, lifted it off, and skinned through the hole into the dark.
and then from the inside pulled the grate back into position. That was always the hardest part, clipping the grate in place from inside. I had to stick a finger through, then wiggle my elbow out and up so my finger could reach the clip, then wiggle the clip until it caught. My fingers just weren't long enough, so it was always a frustrating moment or two until I succeeded. When I had the grate in place, I turned and walked through the dark with a light, steady breeze tickling my cheek. I concentrated on counting the inlets as I passed them. Changing the ship from a colony transport into a city was as big a job as turning my mother into an artist, her project ever since I could remember. And they had this much in common. Neither was completely successful, so far as I'm concerned. In both cases, there were a lot of loose ends dangling that should have been tied into neat square knots. As an example, the point where our quad left off and the ones on either side began was completely a matter of administration, not walls. The quad itself, and they're all this way, was a maze of blank walls, blind alleys, endless corridors, and staircases leading in odd directions. This was done on purpose. It keeps people from getting either bored or lazy, and that's important on a ship like ours. In any case, there are very few straight lines, so in order to save yourself distances, you have to know which way to go. In a strange quad, it's quite possible to get lost if you don't have a guide, and every so often they broadcast a general appeal to be on the lookout for some straying 3-year-old. I was in a hurry to make up lost time when I left the quad yard, so I had gone straight to my shortcut. If the ship were a person, the air ducts would be the circulatory system. Your blood travels from your heart to your lungs, where it passes off carbon dioxide and picks up oxygen, back to the heart, into the body, where the oxygen is used and carbon dioxide is picked up, and then back to the heart again. The air in the ship goes through the ducts to the third level, where it picks up oxygen, then through the ducts and into the ship, where the air is breathed, then back into the ducts and down to the engineers, where water and dirt, carbon dioxide, and germs are removed, and a touch of clean water is added. They kick it around a little more, and then they blow it back up to the third level. The ducts moved in straight lines, and walking within them you could move through walls and arrive almost anywhere faster than you could through the halls. Anybody bigger than I was too big to squeeze through the great openings. There were larger openings for repairmen, but they were kept locked, and all the other kids I knew were too frightened to follow me. So the shortcut remained my own private route. They all thought I was foolish to go where I did, and for the sake of prestige, I liked to pretend that they were right, though they weren't. As long as you avoided the giant fans, you were all right. It was simply that it was people, not things, which frightened me. When I got to our corridor, I slipped the grate out and pulled myself up and out on the floor. I reset the grate and gave a swipe to my hair to teach it to behave and lie down flat again. I inherit my hair and eyes, my straight nose, and my complexion from my Spanish and Indian ancestors on Daddy's side of the family. And though I wear my black hair short, it will misbehave. "Hi, Daddy," I said as I came into our apartment. "Am I late?" The living room was in a real mess. Books and papers were all in piles on the floor, and the furniture was all shoved to one side. Our home ordinarily had a lived-in look, but this was far worse than usual. Daddy was sitting in one of the chairs, sorting books. Daddy is Miles Havero. He is a small man just into middle age, with a face that is hard to read and a very sharp mind. He is mainly a mathematician, though he sits on the ship's council and has for years. He and I had lived in this apartment since I left the dormitory when I was 9. He gave me an inquiring look.
"What happened to you?"
"I didn't mean to be late," I said.
"I didn't mean that," he said. "I'm talking about your clothes."
I looked down. I had on a white shirt and yellow shorts. Across the front of both were streaks of dust and grime. The ship is a place where it is almost impossible to get dirty. The ground in the quadyards isn't real dirt and grass, for one thing. It's a cellulose product set in a milled fiber and plastic base. When a square gets worn, they rip it out and put in a new one, just like in your living room floor. The only place there is dirt in any quantity is the third level, where there isn't anything else but. A certain amount of dirt does get carried out of the third level and spread and tracked around the ship. Eventually, it gets sucked into the collecting chutes and blown down to engineers on the first level, where it is used to feed the converters to produce heat, light, and power inside the ship. But you can see that, ordinarily, there isn't much opportunity to get filthy. I once asked Daddy why they didn't work out a system to keep the dirt at its only source, the third level, instead of going to the trouble of cleaning the ship after it gets dirty. It wouldn't be hard to do. He said,
"You know what the ship was built for, don't you?"
"Yes," I said.
"Everybody knows that.
It was built to carry mud-eaters out to settle the colonies. I don't call them that in Daddy's presence, by the way, though it may seem surprising. He doesn't like the word." Daddy went on to explain. The mud-eaters, Collins, rather, were packed in at very close quarters. They weren't clean people. Try to convince a peasant to wash. And people, packed in as close as they were, are going to sweat and stink anyway. For that reason, mainly, the ship was built with a very efficient cleaning and air distribution system. The ship is used now for a completely different purpose, so we no longer need that system. Daddy said my suggestion wasn't completely out of line.
"Why doesn't the council do something about it, then?" I asked.
"Figure it out yourself, Mia," Daddy said.
He was always after me to try to figure things out myself, before I looked them up or asked him for the answers. I did figure it out. Simply, it would be just too much trouble for too little result to scrap a complicated existing system that worked well at no present cost in favor of another system whose only virtue was its simplicity. I brushed at my shirt, and most of the dirt went its own way. "I took a shortcut home," I said. Daddy just nodded absently and didn't say anything. He's impossible to figure. I was once taken aside and pumped to find out how Daddy was going to vote on a council question. They weren't very nice people. So instead of telling them politely that I didn't have the least idea, I lied. I can't guess what Daddy is thinking. He has to tell me what's on his mind. He set down the book he had been looking at and said,
"Mia, I have some good news for you. We're going to move into a new place."
I gave a whoop and threw my arms around his dear neck. This was news I had wanted to hear. In spite of all the empty space in the ship, we were crowded in our apartment. Somehow, after I left the dorm and moved in with Daddy, we had just never gotten around to trading in his small apartment for a larger one. We were too busy living in the one we had. The one thing I had disliked most when I was living in the dormitory was the lack of space. They feel they have to keep an eye on you there. Moving now meant that I would have a larger room for myself. Daddy had promised I could.
"Oh, Daddy," I said, "which apartment are we going to move into?"
The population of the ship is about 30,000 now, but once we had transported 30 times that many, and cargo besides. The truth is that I don't see where they had fit them all. But now, even though we've spread out to fill up some of the extra space, all the quads have empty apartments. If we had wanted to, we could have moved next door. Then Daddy said, as though it made no difference,
"It's a big place in Geo Quad."
And the bottom fell out of my elation. I turned away from him abruptly, feeling dizzy, and sat down. Daddy didn't just want me to leave home. He wanted me to leave the precarious stability I had worked out for myself. Until I was 9, I had nothing. And now Daddy wanted me to give up everything I had gained since then. Even now, it isn't easy for me to talk about it. If it were not important, I would skip right over it and never say a word. I was very lonely when I was 9. I was living in a dormitory with 14 other kids, being watched and told what to do, seeing a procession of dorm mothers come and go, feeling abandoned. That's the way it had been for me for 5 years. And finally, there came a time when I couldn't stay there any longer, and so I ran away. I got on the shuttle, though I don't know quite how I knew where to go, and I went to see Daddy. I kept thinking about what I'd say and what he'd say, and worrying about it all the distance, so that when I finally got in to see him, I was crying and hiccuping and I couldn't stop.
"What's the matter?"
Daddy kept asking me. But I couldn't answer. He took out a handkerchief and wiped my face, and he finally got me calmed down enough to find out what I was trying to tell him. It took a while, but finally I was finished and had stopped crying, and was only hiccuping occasionally.
"I'm truly sorry, Mia," he said gravely. "I hadn't really understood how things were. I thought I was doing the best thing for you. I thought you'd be better off in a dormitory with other children than living here alone with me."
"No," I said. "I want to live with you, Daddy." He looked thoughtful for a long moment, and then he gave a little nod and said,
"All right. I'll call up the dorm and let them know so they won't think you are lost."
Alphinquad then became one of the two certain things in my life. You can't count on a dorm or a dorm mother, but a quad and a father are sure. But now, Daddy wanted us to leave one of my two sureties. And Geoquad wasn't even on the fourth level. It was on the fifth. The ship is divided into 5 separate levels. First level is mainly technical. Engineers, salvage, drive, conversion, and so on. Second is mainly administration. Third has dirt and hills, real trees and grass, sand, animals, and weeds. It's where they instruct us kids before they drop us on a planet to live or die. Fourth and fifth are residential, where we all live. Of these 5, the fifth is the last. All of us kids knew that if you lived way out on the fifth level, you weren't much better than a mud eater. If you lived on the fifth level, you were giving up one of your claims to being human. I sat in my chair thinking for a long time, trying to recover myself.
"You can't be serious about moving to the fifth level?" I asked,
hoping Daddy might be joking. Not really hoping, more just trying to keep from facing the situation for a moment longer.
"Certainly I am," he said, as though it were nothing. "I had to hunt for a long time before I found this apartment. I've already started getting us ready to move. You'll like it there, I think. I understand there's a boy your age in the school there who's somewhat ahead of you. It will give you a chance to scratch for a while, instead of coasting along with no competition the way you do here."
I was afraid, and so I started to argue desperately, naming all the places we could move into inside Alfing. I even cried, and I didn't do that often anymore. But Daddy was unshakable. Finally, I dragged my sleeve across my face to dry my eyes, and folded my arms and said, "I'm not going to go." That wasn't the right tack to take with Daddy. It just convinced him that I was being stubborn. But it wasn't stubbornness now. I was truly frightened. I was sure that if we moved, things would never be the same for me again. They couldn't be. But I couldn't say that to Daddy. I couldn't admit to him that I was afraid. He came to the chair where I was sitting defiantly with my arms crossed and fresh tears lurking in the corners of my eyes, and he put both of his hands on my shoulders.
"Mia," he said, "I realize that it isn't easy for you. But in less than 2 years, you will be your own master, and then you can live where you please and do as you like. If you can't take an unpleasant decision now, what kind of an adult will you make then? Right now, no arguments. I am moving. You have a choice. Move with me, or move into the dormitory here in Alphinquad."
I'd lived in a dormitory, and I had no desire ever to go back.
I did want to stay with Daddy, but it was still a hard decision for me to make. It was a question of which of my two certainties I wanted to give up. In the end, I made my decision. After I wiped my eyes once again with the lower edge of my shirt, I walked slowly back down to the quad yard. When I got there, both soccer games had broken up, and the whole yard was a turning kaleidoscope of colored shirts and shorts. I didn't see Venny Morlock anywhere in the mass of playing kids, so I asked a boy I knew if he had seen her. He pointed.
"She's right over there."
"Thank you," I said. I got her down. I rubbed her nose in the ground. Then I made her beg to be let up. I got a black eye for my trouble, but it was worth it to make her remember who was who, even if I did live on the fifth level now. After that, Daddy and I moved. Chapter 2. The people who run our schools are very conservative. That probably holds true just about everywhere, not just on our ship. In any case, usually once you get assigned to a tutor, you don't change to another for years. In fact, I knew a boy in Alfinquad who hated his tutor and got along so badly with him that they could both show scars, and it took him 3 years to change to another. Compared to that, anything less has to seem frivolous. Monday morning, 2 days after we moved, I reported to my new school supervisor in GeoQuad. He was thin, officious, prim, and exact, and his name was Mr. Quince. He looked at me standing in front of his desk, raised his eyebrows as he took in my black eye, finished examining me, and said, "Sit down." The supervisor is in charge of all the school's administrative work. He assigns tutors, handles class movements, programs the teaching machines, breaks up fights if there are any, and so on. It's a job with only a minimum of appeal for most people, so they don't make anybody stay with it for longer than 3 years. After looking through all my papers with pursed lips and making a painstaking entry in a file, Mr. Quince said, "Mr. Wickersham."
"I'm sorry," I said, puzzled.
"Mr. Wickersham will be your tutor. He lives at GOC 1537. You are to meet him at his home at 2 o'clock Wednesday afternoon, and thereafter 3 times a week at your mutual convenience. And please, let's not be late on Wednesday.
Now come along and I'll show you your room for first hour. School is for kids between the ages of 4 and 15. After 14, if you survive, they let you give up all the nonsensical parts. You simply work with a tutor or a craft master and follow your interests towards some goal. I was due to make a decision on that in about 2 years. The trouble is that except for math and reading old novels, I had a completely different set of interests than I had had a year before. And since I didn't really have a solid talent for math, and reading old novels isn't much use for anything, I had to find something definite. I didn't really want to specialize. I wanted to be a synthesist, knowing a little about everything and seeing enough to put the pieces together. It's a job that had appeal for me, but I never talked about wanting it because I suspected I wasn't smart enough to handle it, and I wanted room to back down in if I had to. At my moments of depression, I thought I might well wind up as a dorm mother or something equally daring. At some point between 14 and 20, everybody finishes his normal training. You pick something you like and start doing it. Later, after 20, if you're not already in research, you may apply for educational leave and work on a project of some sort. That's what my mother keeps herself busy with. I followed Mr. Quince to the room I was scheduled to be in first hour. I wasn't anxious to be there at all, and I was half scared and half belligerent with no way of knowing which part would dominate at any given moment. When we arrived, there was a lot of sudden moving around. When the people unsorted themselves, I saw there were 4 kids in the room, 2 boys and 2 girls. Mr. Quince said, "What's going on here?" Nobody said anything. Nobody ever does to a supervisor,
if they can avoid it.
He said, "You, Dentremont, what are you up to?"
The boy was red-headed and even smaller than I, with very prominent ears. He looked very young, though he couldn't have been, since he was in the same class as I. He said,
"Nothing, sir."
After a moment of sharp gazing around, Mr. Quince accepted that and unbent sufficiently to introduce me. He didn't introduce anybody else, apparently assuming I could catch on to the names soon enough on my own. The buzzer for the first hour sounded, and then he said,
"All right, let's set to work."
When he left, the red-headed boy went behind one of the teaching machines and busied himself in tightening down the back plate. The girl nearest me said,
"One of these days Mr. Quince is going to catch you, Jimmy, and then there really will be trouble."
"I'm just curious," Jimmy said.
Everybody more or less ignored me, probably no more knowing how to take me than I knew how to take them.
They did watch me, and I have no doubt they took their first opportunity to tell everyone their idea of what that new girl from the fourth level was like. It was soon clear to me that they eyed us as suspiciously as we on the fourth level regarded them, with the added note that in our case it was justified, while in their case it was not. I took no pleasure in having girls look at me and then put their heads together and whisper and giggle, and if I had been a little more sure of myself, I would have challenged them. As it was, I just dug into my work and pretended I didn't notice. After first hour, three of the kids left. Jimmy Dentremont stayed where he was, and since my schedule card called for me to stay here second hour, I didn't move either. He looked closer at me than I could like. I didn't know quite what to say. But then people had been staring and prying and even prodding from the moment we arrived in GeoQuad. Our furniture had been moved over on Saturday morning, the pieces we wanted to keep, and Daddy and I came up on Saturday afternoon bringing everything else that we owned. I had four cartons full of boxes, clothes, and my personal things. I also had a penny whistle that I'd salvaged. It was about 8 inches long and had brass ends and finger holes. It turned up when we were going through our things, in some old box of Daddy's, and he had put it on his to-throw pile, from which I immediately rescued it. Sometimes I don't understand my father at all. The cartons went in my new room, which was larger than my old one. Larger, plus having more bookshelves, which pleased me because I like my books out where I can use them, not piled away for lack of space. I stood looking at the cartons, and not having the courage to attack them immediately, I began experimenting to see what sounds I could get out of the penny whistle. 3 minutes. That was the time we had in peace before the door rang. First, it was our neighbors. They crowded in and said, "Oh, Mr. Havero, it's such a thrill to have you here on our corridor. We hope you love it here as much as we do." And, "Some of us men get together once in a while, you know, for a little evening. Keep it in mind." And, "Oh, so that's your daughter. She's sweet. She's adorable, Mr. Havero. I mean that. I really do. And you know, Havero, there are some things I've been meaning to talk over with our rep on the council. But now that you're here, well, I might as well say it right to you. Go right to the top, so to speak."
After that came the sightseers and the favor-askers. A lot of favor-askers. I could tell them from the neighbors because they tried to butter me up, as well as Daddy. The neighbors just buttered up Daddy.
I don't know why it is, but in a case like this, the very people you'd enjoy meeting are the ones who have the good taste to stay home and not bother you.
I think it may be an unsolvable problem. Within minutes, Daddy retreated to his office, and the people took over our living room while they waited to talk to him. The new apartment had two wings with the living room in between, like the meat in a sandwich. One wing had three bedrooms, a bath, and a kitchen dining room. The other had a study for Daddy and an office. Adjoining the office on the far side was another, smaller, empty apartment. Eventually, this was supposed to be a waiting room, but it wasn't ready yet, and so the people were camping themselves inside our house. I watched the people for a while,
and then I pushed my way through the crowd and went into the bedroom wing. I called up Mary Carpentier from there.
"Hello, Mia," she said. "Seeing you on the vid like this, you might still be home."
"I am still home," I said. "I haven't moved yet."
"Oh,"
she said, and her face fell. She must have had her heart set on a call from a distance.
"I was just fooling," I said. "I have moved."
That brightened her up again, and we talked for a while. I told her about all the people who were squatting in our living room, and we got giggling like madmen about all the imaginary errands we made up for them to have come about. We also swore again that we would be true blue friends forever and ever. When I was done, I went out in the hall just in time to see a heavy-set man coming out of my bedroom. I knew I'd never seen him before.
"What are you doing in there?" I asked.
Before he answered, he stuck his head into the next room for a moment to take a good look around in there. Then he said,
"I'm just poking around. Same as you."
"I'm not poking around," I said quietly. "I live here." He realized then that he'd made a mistake. He didn't say anything. He just turned red and pushed by me hastily. And that's the way things have been ever since. Now, Jimmy Dentremont, looking closely at my face, asked,
"What happened to your eye?"
I don't believe in answering leading questions if I can avoid them, but even beyond that, I had no intention of telling anybody what had happened to my eye.
"How old are you?" I asked in an even voice.
"Why?"
"If you're as young as I think you are, you have no business asking me anything. Children should be seen and not heard."
"Well, I'm older than you are," he said. "I was born November 8th, 2185.
If he was telling the truth, then he was right by 3 weeks to the day.
"How do you know how old I am?" I asked.
"I asked about it when I found you were moving here," he said quite openly.
See what I mean? Staring and prying. The buzzer in the schoolroom sounded to signal the start of the second hour.
"Is this first room?" I asked.
"I don't know," Jimmy Dentremont said. "They don't tell you that."
Well, I knew they didn't. They don't want anybody feeling bad about what level he's studying at, or feeling too good either. But since it's simply a matter of comparing notes, everybody knows just exactly what level his room is. Jimmy Dentremont was simply being contrary. So far, we had been feeling each other out, and I had no idea of how to take him, or even whether or not we could get along. I thought not. Mr. Quince called me in again after lunch, raised his eyebrows once more at my black eye. I had the feeling that he didn't approve of it, and informed me that he had a change to make in my schedule.
"Mr. Mbili," he said, handing me an address.
"Excuse me?" I said.
"Mr. Mbili is your tutor now. Not Mr. Wickersham, as I told you this morning. I assume everything else I told you this morning will apply. Show up at 2 o'clock on Wednesday, and please remember what I said about being late. I don't want the students in my charge being late. A bad reputation always gets back, and I'm the one who has to think up explanations."
"Can you tell me why I'm being switched?" I asked.
Mr. Quince raised his eyebrows. With acerbity, he said,
"That doesn't seem to be any of my business. I was informed of the change, and I am informing you. You may believe that it wasn't my idea. I'm going to have to alter 2 assignments now, and I do not deliberately make work for myself. So don't expect any answers from me. I don't have any."
It seemed like an odd business to me, switching me from one tutor to another before we'd even had a chance to inflict scars on one another. Almost frivolous. In spite of myself, I was glad to meet Jimmy Dentremont on Wednesday afternoon. I was having trouble finding Mr. Mbili's apartment, and he helped me find my way.
"That's where I'm going, as a matter of fact," he said,
standing there in the hall with a slip with the address in his hand. He seemed almost friendly. perhaps because there weren't any other kids around. So far, I hadn't won any friends in GeoQuad, and by being quick-tongued had made one or two enemies, so I didn't object to somebody being pleasant. Is Mr. Mbili your tutor, too?
Well, only since yesterday.
I called Mr. Wickersham to find out why I was being switched around, and he'd only just been told about it by Mr. Quince himself.
You didn't ask to be switched?
No.
That does seem funny, I said.
Mr. Mbili opened his door to our ring.
Hello,
he said, and smiled.
I thought you two would be showing up about now.
He was white-haired and old, certainly well over 100, but tall and straight for his age. His face was dark and lined, with a broad nose and white eyebrows like dashes. Jimmy said,
How do you do, sir?
I didn't say anything, because I recognized him. No name on the ship is completely uncommon, and I knew as many Mbilis as I knew Haveros. I just didn't expect my tutor to be Joseph L.H. Mbili. When he sat on the ship's council, he and my father were generally in disagreement. Daddy led the opposition to his pet plan for miniaturized libraries to be distributed to all the colonies. The third time it was defeated, Mr. Mbili resigned. When I was in the dorm, I once got into a name-calling, hair-yanking fight with another girl. She said that if Mr. Mbili wanted something to be passed, all he had to do was introduce a resolution against it and then sit back. My father would immediately come out in favor of the proposal and ram it through for him. I don't think this girl knew what the joke meant, and I know I didn't, but she intended it to be slighting, and I knew she did. So I started fighting. I didn't know Daddy very well in those days, but I was full to the brim with family loyalty. Assigning me Mr. Mbili as a tutor seemed like another poor joke, and I wondered who had thought of it. Not Mr. Quince, certainly. It had cost him extra work, and his time was precious.
Come inside, Mr. Mbili said.
Jimmy prodded me, and we moved forward. Mr. Mbili tapped the door button, and the door slid shut behind us. He motioned us toward the living room and said,
I thought today we'd simply get acquainted, arrange times that are convenient for all of us to meet, and then have something to eat. We can save our work for next time.
We sat down in the living room, and though there wasn't much doubt as to who was who among the three of us, at least in my mind, we all introduced ourselves.
Yes, I think I've met both of your parents, Jimmy, Mr. Mbili said. And of course, I knew your grandfather. As a matter of interest to me, what do you think you might like to specialize in eventually?
Jimmy looked away.
I'm not positive yet.
Well, what are the possibilities?
For a long moment, Jimmy didn't speak. And then, in a low and unconfident voice, he said,
I think I'd like to be an ordinologist.
If you think of the limits of what we know as a great suite of rooms inhabited by vast numbers of incredibly busy, incredibly messy, nearsighted people, all of whom are eccentric recluses, then an ordinologist is somebody who comes in every so often to clean up. He picks up the books around the room and puts them where they belong. He straightens everything up. He throws away the junk that the recluses have kept and cherished, but for which they have no use. And then he leaves the room in condition for outsiders to visit while he's busy cleaning up next door. He bears about the same resemblance to the middle-aged woman who checks out books in the quad library as one of our agriculturists does to a primitive mud-eater farmer. But if you stretched a point, you might call him a librarian. A synthesist, which is what I wanted to be, is a person who comes in and admires the neatened room and recognizes how nice a copy of a certain piece of furniture would look in the next room over and how useful it would be there, and points the fact out. Without the ordinologists, a synthesist wouldn't be able to begin work. Of course, without the synthesists, there wouldn't be much reason for the ordinologists to set to work in the first place, because nobody would have any use for what they do. At no time are there very many people who are successful at either one job or the other. Ordering information and assembling odd scraps of information takes brains, memory, instinct, and luck. Not many people have all that.
How much do you know about ordinology? Mr. Mbili asked.
Well, not very much at first hand, Jimmy said, and then, with a touch of pride,
my grandfather was an ordinologist.
He was, indeed, and one of the best. You shouldn't feel apologetic about trying to follow him unless you're a complete failure, and you won't be that,
Mr. Mbili said.
I'm not in favor of following ordinary practice simply because it's done. If you don't tell anybody, we'll see if we can't arrange to give you a detailed look at ordinology, and some basis for you to decide whether you want it or not. All right?
It was plain that Mr. Mbili was going to be an unorthodox tutor. What he was proposing was something you don't ordinarily have the chance to do until you're past 14 and back from trial. Jimmy grinned.
Yes, he said. Thank you.
Then Mr. Mbili turned to me.
Well, how do you like living in GeoQuad?
I don't think I'm going to like it, I said. Jimmy Dentremont shot a look at me. I don't think he'd expected me to say that.
What's the matter? Asked Mr. Mbili.
I said, there hasn't been one moment since we arrived here in this quad that we haven't had strangers all over the house. They don't leave us any privacy at all. It was never like this back in Alphen Quad, believe me. Mr. Mbili smiled openly.
It isn't GeoQuad that's to blame, he said. This always happens when somebody becomes chairman. The novelty will wear off in a few weeks, and things will be back to normal again. Wait and see.
After a few more minutes of talk, Mrs. Mbili brought us something to eat. She was somewhat younger than her husband, though she wasn't young. She was a large woman with a round face and light brown hair. She seemed pleasant enough. While we ate, we decided that we would meet on Monday and Thursday afternoons and on Friday night, with the possibility of changes from week to week, if something came up to interfere with that schedule. Mr. Mbili wound up our meeting by saying,
I want to make it clear before we begin that I think your purpose is to learn, and mine is to help you learn, or to make you learn, though I doubt either of you has to be made. I have very little interest in writing out progress reports on you, or sticking to form charts or anything else that interferes with our basic purposes. If there is anything you want to learn and have the necessary background to handle, I'll be ready to help you, whether or not it is something that formally falls among the things I'm supposed to teach you. If you don't have the background, I'll help you get it. In return, I want you to do something for me. It's been many years since I was last a tutor, so I expect you to point out to me when I fail to observe some ritual that Mr. Quince holds essential. Fair enough?
In spite of my basic loyalties, and contrary to them, I found myself liking Mr. Mbili and being very pleased that I had been lucky enough to be assigned to him, even though I couldn't admit it publicly. When we were in the halls again and on our way back home, Jimmy said suddenly,
Hold on.
We stopped and he faced me.
I want you to promise me one thing, he said. Promise not to tell anybody about my grandfather, or about me wanting to be an ordinologist.
That's two things, I said.
Don't joke, he said pleadingly. The other kids would make it hard for me if they knew I wanted to be an odd thing like that.
I want to be a synthesist, I said. I won't say anything about you, if you don't say anything about me. We took it as a solemn agreement, and after that, anything that was ever said in Mr. Mbili's apartment was kept between us and never brought out in public. It was, if you like,
An oasis in the general desert of childish and adult ignorance, where we could safely bring out our thoughts and not have them denigrated, laughed at, or trampled upon, even when they deserved it. A place like that is precious. Jimmy said, "You know, I'm glad now that I was switched. I think I'm going to enjoy studying under Mr. Mbili." Cautiously, I said, "Well, I have to admit he's different." And that was about all that we ever said to anybody who ever asked us about our tutor. I saw Daddy after he closed his office for the day. That is, he closed our living room to new people at 5 o'clock, and by almost 11 he'd seen the last person who was waiting. Excitedly, I said, "Daddy, you know my new tutor is Mr. Joseph Mbili?"
Yes, I know,"
Daddy said matter-of-factly, stacking papers on his desk and straightening up. "You do?" I asked in surprise. I sat down in a chair next to him.
"Yes. As a matter of fact, he agreed to take you on as a personal favor to me. I asked him to do it."
"But I thought you two were against each other," I said. "As I have said before, I don't fully understand my father. I am not a charitable person. When I decide I'm against somebody, I'm against him. When Daddy's against somebody, he asks him to serve as my tutor."
"Well, we do disagree on some points," Daddy said. "I happen to think his attitude toward the colonies is very wrong. But just because a man disagrees with me doesn't make him a villain or a fool. And I sincerely doubt that any of his attitudes will damage you in any way. They didn't hurt me when I studied social philosophy under him 60 years ago.
"Social philosophy?" I asked.
"Yes," Daddy said. "That's Mr. Mbili's major interest."
He smiled.
"I wouldn't have you study under a man who didn't have something to teach you. I think you could stand a very healthy dose of social philosophy."
"Oh," I said. "Well, there was one thing I could say for Mr. Mbili. He hadn't done any eyebrow raising over my black eye. Neither had his wife, for that matter. I did appreciate that. Still, I wished that Daddy had warned me beforehand. Even though I had liked Mr. Mbili, it would have saved me a few uncharitable thoughts right at the beginning." Chapter 3. 2 weeks after we moved, I came into Daddy's study to tell him that I had dinner ready. He was talking on the vid to Mr. Person, another council member. Mr. Person's image sighed and said,
I know, but I don't like making an example of anybody. If she wanted another child so badly, why couldn't she have become a dorm mother?"
"It's a little late to convince her of that with the baby on the way," Daddy said dryly.
"I suppose so. Still, we might abort the baby and give a warning."
"Well, we can bash it all out tomorrow,"
Mr. Person said, and he signed off. "Dinner's ready," I said. "What was that all about?" Daddy said,